I'm aware, and we'll talk to Mr. Lally when that his time comes. Ms. Laporte, do you wish to reserve some time?
Yes, 5 minutes at the end, if I may.
You may. Thank you. You come to the podium and...
Good morning, Your Honors. The major issue before the court today is whether the bankruptcy court abused its discretion in denying appellant's motion to dismiss. The record in herein clearly reflects that appellant produced overwhelming admissible evidence which was not excluded in support of its motion to dismiss, which the bankruptcy court, wholly failed to consider in denying the motion. Specifically, debtor's opposition to the motion and its declaration in support thereof can contain numerous detrimental admissions. This was all brought to the court's attention, and it's throughout my paperwork.
So your point is that even though he struck, you don't argue on appeal that the striking of the transcript of the 2004 examination was improper, do you?
I am arguing that it was improper to the extent that he strictly applied the local bankruptcy rule, which is not part of the federal rules of bankruptcy procedure. It's a more stringent requirement than required under the bankruptcy rules. And he had the discretion not to apply it as strictly and chose to apply it. Not only chose to apply it, but stated that the deposition transcripts were our whole case, that they were substantially all the...
I thought it was a 2004 transcript.
It was a 2000. The court referred to it as a depo transcript, but it was a 2004 examination.
Counsel, you mentioned that the judge struck and used his discretion to strike that. Doesn't the rule permit that?
The rule does permit it. Well, two things I should point out. Yes, the rule does permit it. What we have a problem with is that not only did he strike it, he didn't consider the other evidence. For me, I've gone carefully through this case. The evidence in the 2004 exam, the debtor was evasive. He kept changing his story. The story is truly told in the opposition and his sworn declaration where he admits that he didn't disclose his income post-petition. He admits he didn't disclose his business post-petition. He admits he didn't disclose his... He admits it. He says, I did not disclose it. His reason was, well, I had a paralegal help me prepare the bankruptcy. Well, Your Honors can look at the docket and see that his current counsel substituted in 1 month and a half into the case and filed amended schedules twice thereafter in 2000, I think it was the 2013. Counsel's experienced counsel, you would think he would have gone through the schedules with him, questioned him. Perhaps he concealed his assets and income from his counsel as well. I just know that the schedules were not amended till after we brought our 2004 exam. And then the incredible thing in the transcript of the hearing on this third motion is the judge said he cured the deficiencies, many of the deficiencies. What the debtor did was file in a Schedule AB, which acknowledged that there was a workers' comp board, and the Schedule C that it claimed it exempt. He didn't declare all the 6,000 plus additional income each month, his junkets, his trips, everything that he was doing pre-petition.
Counsel, so, where was that in the record except in the 2004 transcript? Where in the record is it that all of these things were done? He changed the schedules, which he has a right to do, doesn't he, under the rules?
He absolutely, but he has an obligation to do it timely before the plan's confirmed, not 5 years into the case.
Okay, but I guess my question is, where in the record is it that all of these problems with the schedules were revealed except in the 2004 transcript? Is there any other spot?
Throughout the motion to dismiss, there's a specific detailed layout, the foundation, the facts of this case, every step that was taken. and that when the schedules were amended and why they were amended, and we specifically state in the motion to dismiss.
Can I get back to something kind of basic?
Yes.
I really appreciate the detail, but the allegation of the mistake is that the bankruptcy court didn't consider all this other evidence, correct? Okay. So you're not saying that we should rule as a matter of law that the motion to dismiss should have been granted. It's that the judge made a mistake not considering evidence that was presented that wasn't necessarily dependent upon the 2004 transcript. Is that accurate?
Well, I think I'm probably arguing both ways, that he didn't.
I just want to know what you're trying to tell us.
Yeah. Well, I'm focusing right now on the fact that he didn't consider our declarations, Mr. Rose and mine.
All of which you thought was admissible evidence and wasn't dependent on the 2004 exam.
Exactly.
Okay, thanks.
But at the same time, there was abundant evidence before the court of the bad faith conduct. I mean, it's worse than the factors in Levitt, much worse than the factors in Valenti. The fact that we're here today, the fact that in the appellee's brief, they still don't accept responsibility despite the debtor's sworn declaration that he committed fraud is shocking to me.
Well,
this is not a honest and unfortunate debtor.
If we, you know, we have two options here today, or we have multiple options. Affirm, we have an option to reverse, and then we have an option to remand to say, There's technical problems with the decision, and that's sort of a broad, generalized way to put it. We can't do fact finding, so you are arguing in the alternative for either reversal or remand.
Correct.
All right.
And we do believe that there's sufficient facts before the court. Again, I keep directing the court to the sworn declaration of the debtor in support of his opposition, where he admits he admits the gambling junkets to Las Vegas and casinos, and that they gambled. He said we capped it at $300 a day. However, if you look at the statements, I didn't cherry pick those statements as opposing counsel suggests. In fact, what I probably did was not as good, because I tried to pull statements from each month for 5 years to show you every month he was in Las Vegas. He was at the Bally. He was, spending money.
Assuming all that's true, the judge had another point of decision, and that was the issue preclusion or claim preclusion, that somehow there was preclusion and could you talk about that?
Yes, I can. I actually went back through the judge's comments in the transcript of the third hearing very carefully, because I frankly was confused. He was the judge who heard both the prior motions. The allegations were not only set forth in the motion to dismiss, they were in my sworn declaration, where I set forth in detail when the hearings were held, what the issues were, and what the judge's decisions were. So I thought, did the judge read the motion? I mean, it's all there. It's in my declarations. But I think where there had to be some confusion is he stated that I should have raised the issues in the prior motions. Well, had he considered the record in this matter, considered our motion, he would have seen the first motion to dismiss that was combined with a motion for relief from stay was heard on three issues. Insurance had expired on the property. The property was in a deteriorated condition, and all the records we had, payoff, whatever.
Wasn't that motion denied because of a procedural problem, a service problem?
The first motion for relief from stay and motion to dismiss was denied for a procedural problem.
And what about the second, counsel?
The second motion, which has the same issues as this third motion, I will concede that. He made one flat statement, and that is, wasn't served on all creditors, and so it's denied on that basis.
Okay, so both of them were denied for service issues. Okay.
Correct. And we don't deny that, although we would point out that throughout this case, the debtor did not timely file oppositions. He didn't disclose. I mean, his procedural errors were extreme, and yet he tries to portray the creditor as an over-aggressive. When the first trustee holder filed three motions for relief from stay, an objection to both the plans, and the trustee filed the motion to dismiss.
Now, you've got very little time left before we get to your 5 minutes, but there's two issue preclusion arguments kind of going in this case, and maybe when you get back up, talk about what they're arguing on appeal as opposed to what the judge said below, because on appeal they're arguing the preclusive effect of the plan, saying that the judge necessarily determined issues of good faith filing, at least, and good faith presentation of a plan. And so you can either deal with that now and get into your 5 minutes, or take your 5 minutes and...
You know, I think I'll get into that right now, because I want to point out that the debtor raised that really for the first time on appeal, and I understand why they raised it, because Mr. Lawley was one of the attorneys on the In re Valenti case. But I did a very close analysis of In re Valenti in my brief. And it's specifically the case that the debtor relies on specifically supports our point. It says there can't be claim preclusion where there's fraud. And they said this is a very, very narrow holding. And the reason we're finding this is because Schedule I showed rental income in this case. Schedule I showed rental income. Schedule A showed no real property. I don't understand this decision, quite frankly, why it was the creditor's responsibility to investigate it, not the trustee's. I think the trustee should have investigated it, just as I think the trustee should have investigated in this case. But it specifically acknowledges that where there's fraud, there's not claim preclusion. In this case, the debtor concedes. It's like a catch-22. The debtor concealed the fraud so well. I have read through every pleading in this case. There was nowhere prior to the 2004 investigation we would have ever known that he was hiding income. Not till we walked inside that house and saw 50,000 plus in improvements, granite counters, everything that's in my declaration, Mr. Rose's declaration. So we could not discover the fraud until the plan was confirmed. So our argument is it can't have a preclusive effect.
All right. Thank you. We'll reserve the rest of your time.
Okay.
All right. Mr. Lally, are you on the phone?
Yes, I am, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Let me ask you a question. Are you on a cell phone or a landline?
Your Honor, I am on a cell phone. I was not able to get on a landline this morning. I apologize.
Well, our order was quite clear. You weren't allowed to appear unless you were on a landline. Aren't you in a hotel?
Well, no, Your Honor. I'm actually in a conference center right now.
Well, my point is, couldn't you be in a hotel? Are you currently checked into a hotel?
I am currently checked into a hotel. I am actually working at the conference center. I am taking a break. Again, I understand your point very well, and I apologize.
You're in violation of our order. Why should we let you continue to argue?
Well, Your Honor, again, I apologize. I understand the court's order. I tried to comply with the order. I was unable to comply with it this morning, and I apologize for that.
Well, again, explain why you were unable to go back to a hotel room and take the call and then go back to your other activity.
Your Honor, I am working at the control desk of a world championship sports event, and so
table tennis.
I've got a lot.
I'm just telling you. Go ahead.
Yes. I'm sorry, and I, frankly, I have a lot of responsibility. I'm taking a 45-minute break right now, and so that the time factor did not allow me to get back to the hotel room. I thought I was going to be able to, but we had meetings starting at 8 o'clock this morning on the West Coast, and so I wasn't able to have enough time to get back to my hotel room.
All right. We're going to allow you to argue, Mr. Lally, but I want to emphasize to you that this behavior does not reflect well on your attention to the case, your attention to your client, your attention to our orders, or your attention to our institution. So you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, thank you. Your Honor, the way that I would summarize this appeal is the appellant is asking, is it an abuse of discretion for the bankruptcy court to enforce the local bankruptcy rules? And as we have set forth in the opening brief and the excerpts of the record, we would ask the panel to look at this appeal, not simply in the vacuum of the third motion to dismiss, but in the first motion to dismiss, the problems therein, the second motion to dismiss, and the problems therein.
But Mr. Lally, let's assume he had the right to a terminating sanction. Did he make any of the findings that would be necessary to support that conclusion?
No, the court did not.
Okay. Proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. My point in raising that issue is that this appellant had numerous opportunities to get it done correctly, and unfortunately for it, it was not able to do so. Something as simple as in the first motion, the proof of service, as well as in the second, and then when we finally get to the third motion to dismiss, there are still significant procedural problems that the appellant was unable to overcome. And my opinion is that normally a judge can't even get to the merits of a matter unless the matter is brought to the court in a procedurally correct manner.
Now, the judge also struck a declaration supporting your side of the case because it was not filed appropriately, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And the judge struck the 2004 examination transcript in its entirety, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
So her argument, and their argument on appeal, is that notwithstanding that, which is frankly not something that I'm particularly troubled by, the judge was in error in that there was substantial other evidence. He said on the record the 2004 examination is the entirety or most of it, but she's saying today and earlier, not true. Wasn't there significant additional evidence other than the 2004 examination transcript?
Well, we think there was evidence, but we believe it was inadmissible because it lacked foundation. So, for example, when
did you make that argument, or did you make that objection?
I believe it was in the admittedly short opposition of my client and the attorney that filed it before Judge Rizzolo. And so we believe that although there were declarations filed in support of the motion, we don't think they lacked appropriate foundational support for the court to consider the information.
Mr. Lally, if in fact that's true, did the court ever rule on that objection?
Your Honor, on my client's evidentiary objection?
Yes.
One quick moment. I don't think he did, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, and to sort of play that a little bit further, the purpose of the local rule is to give the parties who attended this deposition the opportunity to review a record and make comments the way you would at any deposition, and to streamline the review by allowing the judge to focus on the particular aspects of the testimony that the proponent feels is appropriately focused on, and allow the opponent to highlight things that might be exculpatory or otherwise explanatory. I mean, none of this goes to the fact that a 2004 exam didn't occur, right? I mean, it occurred. So I'm not sure what
Correct.
You mean by foundational in terms of the other documents.
Well, what I mean foundation, and specifically not in terms of various documents, but in terms of statements made in a declaration by either Mr. Rose or Ms. Laporte, statements by the debtor that lacked foundation, because otherwise it would simply be either hearsay or inadmissible for another reason.
To the extent they're saying that a party opponent said this and it's adverse to his interest, isn't that outside the hearsay rule?
Your Honor, you are correct. That is outside the hearsay rule, but I believe Judge Rizzolo held that alone was not sufficient without the 2004 exam.
Where did he say that?
He did not specifically say that. But what he did say was, he said, for example, that at the outset, these evidentiary objections are subject to a substantial weakness, and that every single one of these evidentiary objections, lacking foundation, including where it was clear. And so when I read the transcript, it seems to me that Judge Rizzolo looked at this and said, without the 2004 exam, the declarations are insufficient to meet the creditor's burden of proof.
Where did he say that, counsel? Where is it in the record?
Your Honor, it is not specifically said in the record, but in our brief, we cited the part of the transcript where Judge Rizzolo commented on that. In fact, he says, quote, I think I do have the discretion, if I wish to overrule all of them on that basis, but instead I will rule on each one individually. So the court looked at it from a general perspective, and then he looked at the evidentiary objections individually. And my reading of the transcript was he looked at the evidentiary objections of the debtor and felt that they were well taken, that the declarations of the moving party alone were insufficient to meet the creditor's burden of proof on the motion to dismiss.
Now, he also had substantial documentary evidence, did he not?
Yes, he did.
Okay.
And I must assume that he looked at those documents, like I frankly would expect every judge to look at the documents. And notwithstanding the documents, the court simply held that the motion ought to be denied. I will acknowledge, I believe, admittedly, my take on the transcript was the motion was denied primarily because of lack of evidence, number one, and number two, the procedural rules in terms of not properly marking the 2004 exam transcript pursuant to the local bankruptcy rules.
And also issue preclusion. Why don't you speak to that?
Thank you, Your Honor. The issue preclusion, I believe, addresses two issues. Number one, the res judicata effect of the order confirming the plan. And I've heard Ms. Laporte say that they weren't aware of various issues until post-confirmation. However, as the panel is well aware, any creditor, including this appellant, could have taken the debtor's 2004 exam at any time before confirmation of the plan. And in this particular case, I think that's an important issue because it was initially a Chapter 7 filed November of 2012, converted to Chapter 13 February 4th, 2013, and the plan was not confirmed until December. So from the conversion to the 13 until confirmation, this creditor had 10 months to do a 2004 exam if they wanted to do so, and for whatever reason, they chose not to do so.
Counsel, this is a point of confusion for me, and maybe you can help. I didn't see the judge at the time he made the ruling focusing at all on the preclusive effect of the plan. He appeared to be, from the only record in front of us, focusing on the preclusive effect of the two prior motions. Was the preclusive effect of the plan? Is there anything in the record that suggests that was the basis for his decision?
Your Honor, there isn't anything specific. The court said, and I quote from the transcript, and then also I note that the moving party has failed to adequately address the argument made by the respondent as to why the doctrines of issue preclusion and claim preclusion don't bar relief sought in this motion. And so that statement by the court is not clear or specific as to issue preclusion of the prior motions or of the plan.
Well, isn't there some language after that that talks particularly about the motions?
Yes, there is. And there's a local bankruptcy rule in the Central District that specifically provides that when a motion is denied and a party brings another motion, same motion, that in that motion they must disclose that they filed a prior motion and that it was denied. And I believe that was what the court was focusing on in that statement. And in this case, of course, we had two prior motions that were both denied, and the third motion didn't disclose it, didn't address it, didn't explain why they were denied. And I believe that's what Judge Rizzolo was pointing out, Your Honor.
Mr. Lally, the first two motions, I asked the same question of counsel when appellant's counsel. The first two motions were denied for procedural and service issues. Isn't that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
So neither of the first two motions were decided on the merits, if we want to call it the merits. Isn't that correct?
You are correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. You're welcome, Your Honor. And so the first two motions were denied. It wasn't disclosed. And then the creditor brings the third motion. And I believe the last point that I would like to bring out is that, as the panel is well aware, from the pleadings as well as our brief, the creditor, the debtor filed a motion to strip the creditor's lien. The court had the parties agree on an independent third-party appraiser. The parties filed the stipulation approving that. The appraiser came back and said that there isn't sufficient equity to support any collateral for this lien. So the parties signed a stipulation removing the lien. There's an order approving that. And as set forth in numerous pleadings, this creditor is basically arguing, well, we want the case dismissed because we did not want our lien stripped. As the panel is aware from the docket that we've provided, the creditor never filed an appeal of the order stripping its junior lien. And so that's a final order. It's a non-appealable order. But yet in the pleadings as well as on appeal, this creditor is basically trying to argue, well, I want my lien to remain. And the way to achieve that is to get the case dismissed. And so that's why we've argued this is effectively either a disguised appeal of the order stripping the lien or an improper collateral attack of the order stripping the lien.
To get there, didn't your client have to do something that was questionable? I mean, I get your point. That's cool. I don't think there's any doubt that's the motivation for the actions. They would like to have their lien back. But it seems to me a little disingenuous to say, and I'm not saying you said it quite this way, my client did something improper and now they're using it to their own benefit.
That's not what I'm saying.
Well, that's why I said I'm not saying you said that exactly, but that's how I'm hearing that.
I understand. I don't think my client did anything wrong. My client amended the schedules correctly, as the panel pointed out. In fact, a debtor has an obligation to amend the schedules, when required or necessary to do so, and that's what my client did.
That's all for proof, and the problem is that hasn't happened yet. There hasn't been a full hearing on the merits of this. And that's really, that's the main concern I think the appellant has today.
Well, I can understand why with all the procedural problems that they've created, unfortunately, but not to sound too harsh, but that's their problem because, you know, I don't think the court can get to the merits unless the creditor brings the motion correctly before the court. And then once that's done correctly, then the court, I believe, has an obligation to look at each issue on the merits. But we've never gotten to that because this creditor can't seem to, no offense, they can't seem to get it done correctly. And as we all know, this is the third bite of the apple. And at some point, there's got to be finality. And 6 years into this case, with a discharge pending, my client is entitled to finality.
Well, and again, that goes back to your time is up, but I would just say, again, you've already conceded, however, that to the extent it was a sanction, the appropriate findings weren't made.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much, Your Honor. I appreciate it.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honors. First, I need to correct a few misstatements. One, I noticed this in the paperwork. There's confusion. The only objections made in the third motion to dismiss were my client's objections.
That was a question.
And he refers to, and that was another error that I think the court made because they said they were fraught with Lane Foundation. If he granted many of those.
But he struck one of the declarations in its entirety.
He did strike because it was filed untimely. It's the first time he struck an untimely opposition in this case. But I wanted to clarify that. I also wanted to clarify that I don't know how to get debtor or opposing counsel to read our motion to dismiss. It specifically states in the motion in my declaration that has a full description of all three motions to dismiss. It explains why the first motion didn't have the same issues as the second two, and it explains why each one was denied.
Your declarations did not have all the information to the letter that the local rule requires, but you did generally disclose the prior motions.
And why they were denied.
All right.
So and there were no objections by the debtor to the evidence presented by appellant in support of the motion to dismiss, and there were no rulings on it. I specifically asked the court to consider the evidence in all the statements we provided, the documentation provided, the admissions, Mr. Rose's and my declarations. He never mentioned it. You can tell when you read the transcript, it was as if he ignored me. I feel as he just ignored it and focused in on the deposition transcripts. And to correct one thing, the judge could have granted our motion that day based on the other evidence before it and chose not to. One of the basis in the exercise of discretion in ruling on a motion to dismiss requires that the bankruptcy court balance the interest of the honest and fortunate debtor in receiving a fresh start against the fairness to creditors. I don't think that this court did that. And instead, this is not a debtor that falls with the honest but unfortunate debtor. It's until this day, through the last hearing, neither the court or debtor has acknowledged the severities of his failures to disclose. And the debtor's suggestion that we should have done a 2004, are we supposed to go on fishing expeditions now as creditors' counsel in every case if we can't discern fraud in the schedules or just in case so it's not issue preclusion at a later date? That's not certainly not within the spirit of the law, and I see my time's up. So thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments. This matter will be under submission.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Let me call the next matter.